Hey there, this is Walt, and today on the BamfBot podcast genre series, we're talking all things action, small, cool devices that now fit into cell phones, and cars that can drive themselves. We're talking action and intrigue on the BamfBot podcast. Today I'm joined by two awesome guys who have run in and out of the RPG scene, as well as have torrid love affairs with comics and action in comics. We have Chuck Rice from Mayfair Games. How you doing, sir?
Great. How's it going?
Not caffeinated enough yet to answer that question properly. and then we have Dom Sumner from New Millennium Games, who has done copious amounts of products for Supers, Icons, Mutants and Masterminds through that imprint, as well as worked on products for Villains and Vigilantes. How are you doing today, sir?
Okay, so far. We'll see how the day develops.
We're talking action and intrigue today, and on the series so far, we've usually started off with what we define as what we like about action and intrigue. So movies that really focus on wowing the audience with eye candy and nonstop motion usually end up in this category. What do you guys think? What for you makes... I apologize. I have a tank with ears chewing on a bone. So if you guys hear anything weird, that's what it is. What do you guys think about action and intrigue movies? For you, what makes that genre?
For me, it's something that pretty much keeps me entertained throughout the entire movie. You think Die Hard, the Die Hard series, Lethal Weapon series, the Bourne series movies, any of the James Bond films. Just basically something that I can suspend belief of in and watch.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I like, for me as a kid, it was in the movies anyway, it was as close as I could get to comics on a movie screen, right? Die Hard is, he's kind of like Batman.
Way over the top.
Yes, exactly. So James Bond.
If I step on a Lego, I'm dying. And if you get him running around with glass in his feet, killing 15 terrorists.
Exactly. And that was the realistic one of the bunch. But yeah, like James Bond, the Die Hard movies. And then, of course, getting a bit more into the fantastic, but definitely still action, the Terminator movies. Like those were as close as I could get to comics. So I was kind of watching them from that standpoint, but obviously they have their own appeal and they've changed over time. Like Bond these days has definitely tried to steal Jason Bourne's lunch, I think. So
and succeeded a little bit, especially with Daniel Craig's performances. He's very, very forward as an actor in that role.
Yeah, totally.
What about books? Did you guys do a lot of intrigue style books when you were coming up?
Back when I was in high school, I had a buddy of mine that was like really into Mac Bolan, and every time he'd read one, he'd give it to me to read after he was done with it.
Curious enough, we have somebody else on the podcast who has a Mac Bolan addiction.
Yeah, I was a big going into the used bookstores. This was back when that was a thing, and you could walk out with 10 Mac Bolan books for $10. And I really, that was a great series because he went from being the Punisher, which in case people don't know, the Punisher is a very, very actionable ripoff of Mac Bolan. it's amazing to me that no one ever sued anybody, but I guess they just weren't that into it. But it was a character created by one guy, a pulp writer, Don Pendleton, who his family was wronged by the mob, and he was a Vietnam sniper, and so he was running around killing the mob, and then the series was literally bought by Harlequin Romance, who started an imprint for guys, and they turned him into an international man of mystery.
Because that always happens to the Punisher.
Killing terrorists. They took him from killing the mob in the United States to roaming the world killing terrorists. And this is in the 80s.
Nice. Now, with books like that coming up, you know, obviously you're going to have to get some exposition in a novel format, because I mean that's how that rolls. Where does story come into, you know, a good action property? You know, how much of it has to be eye candy and how much of it has to be a story that grabs you? I mean, Dom is always on record as saying he has to be entertained, but if the action is entertaining, does the story matter?
Yeah, story always matters. I, however, am more of the belief that character is more important than plot. So from that standpoint, when you have an ongoing series, your job is to be consistent to the character as he exists, to introduce the character to a new reader, and then, you know, and then you can, you know, like using Mac Bolan books as an example again, they would have exposition from the standpoint, again, they were literally Harlequin romances owned by that same crew. Harlequin has this great research department, whether you're a 17th century pirate or whatever. And so they would actually give you enough information about, say, modern day Algiers to set the scene and introduce the villain and introduce the character. And then it would be him parachuting in and figuring out what dastardly nonsense they were up to, and then shooting guys in the face.
Like you do.
Yes.
Now with things like James Bond, you also have like big settings, and you know, with Mac Bolan, James Bond, Jason Bourne, you know, you have all these big set pieces that they usually film over. Are we seeing a shift now with properties like Daredevil and Luke Cage to where we don't need the set pieces to be globe spanning anymore? Things can take place in a neighborhood or in some cases a single hallway.
Especially a single hallway. Well, sure. I mean, you've got lower level conflicts, but you can still make the stakes feel big. And especially in the case of the Marvel series, they don't have to figure this out themselves, right? Like Frank Miller and Brian Michael Bendis, you know, have kind of already charted that ground for them about low scale conflicts but high stakes.
Well, in shows like Daredevil and Luke Cage, the actual neighborhoods are almost like their characters in the shows themselves. They help set the mood for everything. Development is the characters in the background help with the show, and it helps keep the focus of the show on just one small area where you're not going off in other parts of New York City.
Right, absolutely. And having New York City be, you know, New York City is such a great place with so much character. Like I know Jerry Conway, who obviously was a great Spider-Man writer, but who also created, quote unquote, created the Punisher, because again, he's ripping off Mac Bolan. But when he was a writer for Law and Order, the classic TV series, he was always pounding his fist on the table saying, look, this is in New York. New York has to be a character in the show. And so, as an example, that show became much better once Jerry Conway joined the writer's room and was like, this is New York, guys. Come on. What are we doing?
Right on. And you see that in, especially in Luke Cage, where Harlem is so heavily portrayed and really has a vibrant sense of community and a vibrant atmosphere to it. I mean, you know, just Pop's Barbershop alone, I mean, I could sit in a place like that all day and just listen to those guys go back and forth. You know, the nightclub, you know, had that atmosphere of, you know, the central meeting place for when the lights go down. You just got this sense of that each particular facet of that show was not only its own set piece, but almost its own character. You know, you could almost sense the personality of the place right from the very first shot of that scene. That's actually pretty cool. What about when you're dealing with where the set pieces don't have that much personality? Is all that burden now on the actors and the writing, or can we get away with a balance, let's say?
Well, I mean, the actors can definitely carry the weight, right? Like if you look at Jessica Jones, like they're really even less than Daredevil or Luke Cage. There are no real set locations that matter for that. But again, I think that's fine because yes, New York can and should be a character, but in a case like that where you had so much drama between her and Luke Cage and Purple Man, then you know, and such great actors, and I think David Tennant really is probably the best villain that we've ever seen in any Marvel property, perhaps. Then characters can kind of carry the whole thing.
What do you think, Dom?
Well, a lot of the best parts of Jessica Jones were just the tension between Jessica Jones and Kilgrave, where they're in a room or they're just talking to each other. And that kind of set the mood for the entire show. Yeah, there was some action here and there, like in the apartment when she was chasing him. But a lot of interactions between just those two main characters is what set the whole show up.
Yeah.
And if any of you guys ever seen a show called Orphan Black on the BBC, BBC America?
What's the name of the show?
Orphan Black.
Oh, yeah. That show's intense.
Yeah.
Like I said, there's not a lot of times it doesn't have a really big budget.
Yeah.
And it focuses on a few characters here and there. There's a lot of action going on in certain scenes, but it's a good show overall. And like I said, I people get kind of hooked into it, and you want to find out more about those characters.
Right.
And that actress is intense too, because she has to play so many different roles.
Yeah.
You know, that's pretty wild.
She should win all the acting awards, I think.
You get all the awards.
She's playing the hero, playing the villains, playing supporting characters.
Right on. They're going to have to give her a little red wagon to pull all the awards with out of the show.
Yeah, she's won a couple of awards, from what I understand.
Yeah. That show's wild. Like I said, she's to be able to play so many different characters as the same actress on the same show, that's going to be wild. It's also going to be interesting to see if they can pull off the same thing with Legion coming up on Fox for pretty much a different spin on the same angle. But speaking of characters and how set pieces can be a characters, what part does gadgets and stuff like that play in an action sequence? Because I know for myself, if I'm looking at an action movie and everything's on the rail, it's going great. You know, I can feel the flak coming off of the rounds as they're being ejected from the rifle, you know, and then all of a sudden somebody runs out of ammunition and they're holding a rifle and there's multiple clicks of the trigger. And I'm just like, oh no, you didn't, you know, and you know, it takes me out of that action because as a person who's dealt with firearms, much like yourself, Dom,
the things that kill me in a film are where I see the guy. The classic scene where the guy goes to check his weapon. He drops the magazine out. He looks. He's got one round in the magazine and says he's only got one shot left. I'm like, it drives me up the wall. That or where I can clearly see the guy slide lock back at a scene. He's out. He's completely dry. And they're still firing. Like, how did nobody catch that?
You know, but you know, those are like the minor foibles that pull you out of the action sequence. What about the gear itself? What do you guys like about the gear? I know I love an action movie where, you know, I think it's a throwback to those old Bond movies where you had Q talking to Bond and, you know, the witty banter back and forth over a table full of gear. But I love those gear scenes, especially if they can come up with something that's almost plausible, but you know, they got to use it in the scene.
It could happen. Yeah. They could make it. They might not quite be at that tech level yet, but it could happen.
Oh, I love the gear. What about you guys? What do you guys love about the gear, or if you do or not, or do you think it's not necessary to the plot?
Well, for me, it depends on the film. Like for Bond, it works because that's been a staple of the James Bond movies the whole time. Come up with a little device that helps him save the day or get out of a bad situation. So Q's worked it out, and it, you know, at some point during the film, you're going to get to see him use it. You're going to get him to see him lose his little laser pin, his little rebreather, his car, a little gyrocopter with the weapons on it. Other movies, it just, like I said, it varies from film to film. And there's certain films I'm going to watch. I don't expect a lot of believability, like The Expendables. If I'm watching The Expendables, I'm not looking for a lot of pot. I'm not looking for a lot of great acting. I know there's going to be some action scenes, a lot of gunfire, and a lot of explosions, and I'll be mildly entertained for an hour and a half to 2 hours.
Right on. Yeah, for that, you're more looking for, oh my God, Chuck Norris is in this. Everybody's going to die. yeah. How about you, Chuck? What do you think about the gear?
For me, it depends. I mean, like, I think a lot of my favorite action series, the gear is more toward the realistic side. You know, you've got like Jack Bauer, for example. But it does work in James Bond, mostly in a lot of the Bonds, honestly, as more of a combination plot device and almost a humor element. You know, it's like, oh, he had a rocket in his ballpoint pen. Of course he did. You know, and it's just so over the top in some of them that it's funny. But because certainly for a time, like they've definitely gone back to being more of an action franchise. But I almost feel like in the Roger Moore, Pierce Brosnan era, James Bond was almost camp. They never went all the way there, but they came pretty close. Whereas now that he's kind of back to being more of a member of the modern action genre of Jason Bourne and Jack Bauer.
Well, they went to more of like, with the new iteration, they went with more of Fleming's.
Yes.
Or Broccoli iteration, where it's, where he was a brutal sociopath in the books.
Yes. Well, because of course he was. He's a government assassin. I mean, it, of course he is.
You know, but I mean, I was very shocked because, you know, I mean, his portrayal was very stern in the beginning of Casino Royale. Yep. And then as the movie progressed, I'm like, oh my God, I can see what they're doing here. This is great.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was, and of course it didn't hurt that it was Daniel Craig. And I asked my wife later, I said, what'd you think of the movie? She's like, oh, I really like that. I'm like, what'd you think of, Daniel Craig? And she's like, well, that he was the only one in it. So, I mean, it was good. Yeah. That's what I figured.
Well, that's Alpha Protocol, which is not a great game, but I think it's worth talking about. That's a video game.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I think it's worth talking about in the sense of they tried to make an all-inclusive spy RPG, and they went for what they called the three Bs, which they defined as Bond, Bourne, and Bauer. And so
that's awesome.
Yeah.
Actually, it'd be the three JBs because they're all films and initials are JB.
Yes, exactly. And so that they were looking at, you know, would you solve this with gadgets? If so, that's the kind of Bond solution to this part of the game. Would you use kind of stealth and martial arts, and then that would be Bourne, and then it, you know, are you just going to shoot guys and be real effing brutal, and that's obviously Bauer.
Oh, if only we could have what has happened in TV today and get Jack Bauer for president.
Well, actually, isn't he doing a show right now? Keith Sutherland doing a show where he is the president, which is funny.
That's what I was talking about. I was like, yeah, this is great.
Now, you know what I want? I want Dennis Haysbert to be president and Jack Bauer to be the guy running around shooting people who need to be shot. That's what we actually need.
Yes. Yeah. Oh my goodness. That would be great. I love that actor too. He's just got that voice. The timbre of his voice is just like, you know, I mean, I don't care if he's the president on 24 or he's reading an Allstate commercial. Anytime that guy's on screen, I can listen to him all day.
The unit also, by the way, is him. And that's another really good, I think. Well, okay, at first it was a realistic action series. Yeah. Eventually, like, there's an episode of that series, like, in the third season where they go rogue to protect a country singer that someone wants to kill. Like, that show just got dumb toward the end, but...
Yeah, I think that was during the whole writer's strike, because...
It was.
I was in... actually, Dom and I, together, were both at Al-Assad.
Al-Assad Air Base Iraq.
Yep. And I had a friend actually in the United States and a couple of friends in Canada who were sending me podcasts, and they were actually burning them to CDs for me so I wouldn't have to spend $34.50 a minute on internet, and I was listening to a podcast. Somebody was talking about the third season of the unit and how it had gone off the rails pretty much because during the writer's strike, they basically brought in all these new writers who didn't have, you know, a good grasp of the concept of the show. So it was like, ugh, this sucks. Because those first two seasons were fantastic. You know?
Well, they also didn't have a good concept of writing. I mean, like there are some tremendous memos from that season of the unit where David Mamet, mostly against his will, but because he was classified as management, he didn't get to go on strike and he was still there. And that whole show was his idea. And he was literally sending them memos, like breaking down what dramatic conflict is. Like if two characters are talking to each other, one of them needs to want something and one of them needs to want to stop the other one from getting it because that's what drama is.
Oh God. That was terrible.
Yeah.
You know,
well, another show that started off pretty good and got sidetracked by the writer's strike. Remember the Terminator Sarah Connor Chronicles?
Yes.
It started off and I was like, I was really into the show right before I left to go to Iraq. And then I came back. I'm like, okay. And I'm like, what the hell happened?
Yeah, exactly. That sucks.
It's like they were, by the way, Walt, guys are just sitting around. Hey, wouldn't it be cool if we did this next week?
Ugh.
Exactly. I think that podcast.
What were you going to say, Chuck?
I was going to say, I think that podcast that you were talking about of someone railing against season 3 of the unit, I think that was me on the Accidental Survivors.
That might have been Fraser who sent me that because he sent me basically an entire season. Yeah, yeah. He's awesome guy. Sent me a whole bunch of podcasts on CDs so I wouldn't lose my mind on big patrols.
Yeah. I do believe that. Talk about your past coming back to haunt you.
Oh, my God. It all comes around.
I helped him when he did the second edition of Blood and what game was it? For the D20. It was for D20 Modern. And I think it was one of the special ops releases they did.
He did a book called In His Majesty's Service about British operatives.
British Special Operations Units. And he also did one on basically Western Special Operations. And I helped him do a lot of the research for it.
Yeah.
Because I did a read over for it and helped him correct a couple things in it and send him some stuff I had written for magazines.
Yeah, now we're getting into territory for the same territory that was discussed on the last issue of the Accidental Survivors. Got into pretty much the same thing, how they were going in and seeking out people who they knew had experience in these fields, in these very action-oriented fields, and making sure it legitimized what they were looking at. How do you guys feel about that kind of stuff in an action movie? How much is a technical advisor necessary? I mean, is it okay for the average consumer to just have, you know, the multiple pulls of a trigger, even though a rifle doesn't do that when it's empty? Or, you know, the guy has fired 40 rounds out of a 20-round magazine.
It depends on the movie. Like, if you ever watch Heat, I know they brought in advisors that had served in the Special Air Service and had served in Delta to actually advise them on how an actual firefight would go down. And they trained with them. Same thing with, like, the I'm drawing a blank right now. Keanu Reeves.
John Wick.
John Wick movie. I know he's been doing they brought in somebody to help him, and also they sent him basically to a couple of different shooting schools for the next of the new John Wick film. There was even a video online him doing basically a 3-gun match, firing pistol, rifle, and shotgun, where he'd gone to like about 6 months worth of firearms training.
Well, Keanu is a guy that really seems to believe in doing his own stunts, right? Like he spent so much time with Wu Peng in when he was making the Matrix movies. Like he's not a martial arts guy, and he's fighting guys like Colin Chu, and he's like, no, I actually want to do this, and of course that's Wu Ping's philosophy too, so they got along great.
Oh yeah, I'm so stoked to see that that next John Wick film. Because yes. I mean, yes. I didn't see it in the theater. I bought it streaming, and then you know, I brought everybody over to the house, and I said, I don't know, it's a Keanu Reeves gun flick. I mean, you know, how can you go wrong? During the pivotal scene, which sets up the whole movie, my wife sits there and tells me to pause it, and everybody in the room is just silent. We had like four dudes over with, you know, like snacks and you know, burgers and stuff, and everybody's just silent as I pause it, and I'm like, everybody all right? And they all look at me and are like, that dude needs to die.
Yeah. See, I actually,
I mean, that go ahead.
I was going to say, I actually saw that movie in the theater because they had me at, you know, the thing that triggered his killing spree was that they killed his dog. They had me right there.
Stole his car and killed his dog.
Yes.
Right. You know, but then you have, I love the scene because it really sets up what is going to happen in this movie, you know, because you got this in the beginning, you just got a guy who's grieving, you know, and I love the scene where the Russian mob boss is just sitting here and he's talking to his kid and the lawyer, and he's just like, you don't understand, that guy is John Wick. And then he starts going into the legend of Baba Yaga, you know, the Russian boogeyman, and they're interposing the scene back and forth. It was just amazing.
And you've also got, now if you want to talk about over the top movies, you've got Bad Boys 3 coming out next year.
What?
Yes. Bad Boys 3 is coming out.
Is that Michael Bay again?
Once again, Michael Bay is back.
Oh my
goodness.
It's going
to be summer of 2017.
And Will Smith and Martin Lawrence?
They're both in it.
Wow.
That is amazing. Okay. way to reboot, revive. It's like, get the paddles. We got one more left.
See, it's so much harder, but I always love, I think some of the best action movies are the ones that actually do get it right. And I'm thinking of Heat, and I'm thinking of Black Hawk Down, right? Man, Black Hawk Down is such a good movie. I think I'm going to have to go watch that again today.
I'll refrain.
Now why? Tell me why.
Some of the stuff I just you know, like the we were talking earlier, you know, that somebody pulls the trigger repeatedly on a rifle. Some of the stuff they were doing in that just took me out of the movie because I couldn't get into some of the things they were doing. Like for example. The master sergeant walking through the chow hall, and they're like, hey, you need to put that weapon on safe. And he like wiggles his finger and he's like, this
is my safety,
you know, and a professional isn't going to do that. He's going to adhere to whatever the rules are as far as, you know, like when you're on base, you know, you walk onto a forward operating base and they tell you that your weapons have to be in this grade. Nobody's going to mess with that because they're not going to let you in. And if they see you're not on safe, they're going to call you on it. They're going to do certain stuff. Or like, McKnight walking through a hail of gunfire, you know, with his hands on his hips. No, it doesn't work like that. You know what I mean? It, so stuff like that, you know, even though the movie had some very intense moments and they were, you could tell what they were trying to do. They were trying to do justice. This is very, this very visceral situation, especially after Todd Blackburn fell and things start going to hell. There were just certain things in the movie I couldn't get behind because of working in that field. You see certain things like that, and it's just like, ugh, you're killing it.
That and then the, you know, like the major changes they made in Lone Survivor.
Oh yeah,
they
absolutely
changed a lot of stuff.
Okay, you know. See, I haven't seen that.
You haven't seen Lone Survivor?
No.
Have you read the book?
Yeah.
Yeah, the book was fantastic, but the movie, they made some changes. Go ahead, Dom.
Or like I said, movies like Lone Survivor, 13 Hours, where they actually based it on real events, and they make changes to make things more, I guess, more cinema, you know, basically beef it up for the movies. And there was absolutely nothing wrong with what happened in real life. They just chose to make changes. I'm not sure why. But, again, people were not quite happy with them. You guys remember seeing the series on HBO, Generation Kill?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was a great series.
Yeah, because I know several of the people that were actually involved in that unit, and they were not happy with some of the changes they made.
Yeah, so, I mean, you see stuff like that, and the guys that are there that will sit there and shake their head and just be like, ah, you didn't do it. Because in some cases, that real-life action is much more intense. That's why you're starting to see, for the last 3 or 4 years, you're seeing a slew of videos online about actual firefight videos, you know, and how things like John Wick come about is these producers see these videos and say, holy crap, that is way more intense than, you know, this choreographed Matrix stuff.
You don't think that it might be that they actually think the realism might make it too intense in some cases?
If you look at something like John Wick, where you're getting, you know, a guy being rolled over using, a jiu-jitsu pass through, and then he's being stabbed repeatedly and having throats ripped out and stuff like that. I mean, look at Indiana Jones.
Those are fictional scenarios. Like when you're talking about guys in Somalia, you know, there's that, don't you think that makes it different?
I think now you're talking about different genres within the action genre itself.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Because now where you're like John Wick is something that's meant to entertain as much as it is to pay homage to those great action films of the past. You got things like Black Hawk Down and Lone Survivor, which are more
based on reality.
Based on reality.
But
so
also
they're
still primarily designed to entertain.
Correct. Yep.
Well, if you want to be designed to entertain, the perfect example of that, let's Act of Valor. Act of Valor basically sprung out of the Navy trying to make a recruitment video for the SEALs to boost the number of SEALs they were getting. And so the company that started shooting on this video ended up went to the Navy with an idea to make an action movie. So the footage they shot that was going to be used for the recruitment video for the SEALs, they tacked on more to it, ended up using real Navy SEALs and EOD guys and SWIT guys and made an action movie.
You can tell that those guys weren't actors, you know, but at the same time, you could also tell that when they were going in and kicking down the door, you had no doubt that they knew what they were doing.
Right.
So
the interesting thing about Act of Valor also is that the things that put them in the most danger, like struck me as I was watching, is like one guy that they didn't know was there with like a little, you know, 9mm that was just kind of tucked away in the corner. That the first guy that walks through the door is going to have a really bad day from that guy.
Oh, you're talking about when they stack up outside the door and they go in?
Yeah.
Well, now you're talking about dynamics of room breaching and room clearing.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean,
well, one of the more insane things in the movie is when they did the what they call a hot extraction of the guys down in Central America when they were covering the CIA agent. Mm-hmm. That was an actual live fire exercise they had done as part of the recruitment video. And those were actual real bullets they were firing. Those weren't blanks. Those were real explosions. They just weren't firing at the guys. What they're doing, what they'll do is they'll fire near them. So the guys, you get used to the sound of gunfire and explosions going off around you. So that when it happened for real, you don't panic.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of taking that realism to 11, what do you guys, going back to the technical advisor thing, what do you guys think of comics and stuff like that, like The Activity, where they actually caught the imagination of special operators and were invited down to places like SWCC to experience some of that training. Do you think that that will change the tone of a series?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm the worst person to judge my own work. But, like, I know, like, in the case of like, when I was doing Blood and Guts, I was very specifically looking at, you know, reaching out to people like you, Walt, and guys like Fraser and guys like Rich Spanauer, because I was dealing with D20 Modern, which, you know, I guess what I'm saying is my goal was not to be realistic, but just to be realistic enough to allow you to suspend disbelief. So there's definitely a line. Like I don't think of a role-playing game that was too realistic, I'm not sure it would be fun.
What I call cinematic realism.
Yes, exactly.
Well, for like The Activity, I know they actually interviewed some guys that had served in like different special operations units. They talked to guys that actually served in the intelligence support activity, which is a unit is based on. They talked to some SF guys, Rangers, some guys that have been in Delta, guys that have been on the regular SEAL teams. I think they'd spoken with a couple different guys that have been in like units like Dev Group and whatnot. And so they got input from them, and it helped with the series itself.
Right.
Actually, I'm hoping it comes back. It was a good series. I enjoyed it.
And this is I'm actually not familiar with this series. Is it Dark Horse?
Image. Who?
Image, okay.
You can get the if you want to go back, they've got like three trade paperbacks out now to collect with the series so far.
I'm gonna have to grab that.
Check it out. I'm serious, it's pretty good.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Now, if you want a slightly more what I call comic book version, any of you guys checked out the new Terminator series that DC's doing? Deathstroke?
No, okay. No.
This reboot has got Christopher Priest is writing it.
Nice. I always liked Deathstroke.
The first place I really didn't have stroke was in the second issue of New Teen Titans, because New Teen Titans was the series that actually got me collecting comics, and I've been following them ever since. I haven't liked some of the stuff DC's done in the last couple of years, but
yeah, I'll bet
the new series so far it's keeping my interest.
Okay, yeah, I was a big fan of that Perez Wolfman Teen Titans run also. Yeah.
Well, that I liked back in the late 80s, early 90s when he had his series that Marv Wolfman was writing. I like was picking that up. And you guys ever check out the original DC Checkmate series?
Yes.
Because it was linked in where you had Deathstroke, Checkmate, and Suicide Squad were all kind of linked together.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of some other series that have been decent. I don't know. A lot of the stuff that's out now, I'm not sure what's going on with everybody wants to have these guys with these huge guns and running around shooting up everybody, and I'm like, it's really not. They just don't click for me.
Yeah, it's the '90s all over again, right? Like in the Jim Lee era of the X-Men. Even if you were Bishop and you had mutant powers, you still need to have a big gun.
That was the '90s, sir. That was the '90s. You got to have big shoulder pads, big guns.
Yeah, and straps everywhere. Straps pockets that don't hold anything. Straps and pockets. Yes.
Oh, I'm starting to think. What other series are out there right now that I've actually found happily entertaining? Now, if you want to talk different games. Yeah, you ever played Twilight 2000?
Oh, my God, yes.
Twilight 2000, yeah. You remember, and you want to talk about a super realistic game, FGU's Aftermath. It was super detailed.
Yeah, I would almost say too realistic. Again, I think at a certain point, it becomes not fun.
Yeah, I mean, they had tables for everything. And I mean, they had area, the little chart for where your rounds would impact on you if you hit a target. I'm trying to think of some other series that came out during that time. Delta Force. It was an RPG, Delta Force role-playing game.
Yeah.
That came out with a couple different source books and adventures. Some of the stuff wasn't too bad. And for Hero Games, they had a release set in Vietnam called Here There Be Tigers.
Yep, which I owned and really liked and ran. Now, I, of course, turned it into a G.I. Joe game. But
actually, that wouldn't have been too bad. I'm surprised nobody ever jumped on that back in the 80s when G.I. Joe was really popular. A G.I. Joe role-playing game. I am really surprised nobody jumped on that.
Here's a little inside baseball. I was at a dinner for Mayfair with a gentleman that worked at Wizards of the Coast, and I said to him, so, you know, I'm just a guy that you just met and don't know. So feel free to tell me to fuck off if this question is out of bounds. And he says, oh, I will. And I said, why has there never been a G.I. Joe RPG? And he was actually floored by the question. He said no one had ever asked him that before. He had never really given it a lot of thought, and that he couldn't understand either, now that I was asking him the question, why that hadn't happened, and claimed he was going to run it up the flagpole. But to me, that is shocking. Like, how is that not the first thing you bring up in your first meeting if you get hired by Wizards?
I'm thinking these guys had toys. They had the comic book, which was carrying Marvel for a while, just the comic book sales from them. The TV show. And it was like the biggest thing that they had going right then of the Transformers. And I'm like surprised nobody ever came up with RPG for it. And at the time, I thought Palladium's Recon, when Palladium bought the Recon game, surprised that nobody took that and used it as a basis, because they could have based it off of that.
Oh, well, yeah, there are systems that you can do. Like the game that I ran, I used Danger International. I used Aaron Alston's Super Agents source book, and then Here There Be Tigers. And I kind of melded them together, and it worked pretty well. It was a game that lasted about a year, I would say.
Yeah, and you also had the James Bond game and Top Secret out at the time.
Top Secret SI, yeah.
And I can't. Who made the James Bond RPG? I don't remember right now.
Oh,
I'd actually have to look it up.
Yeah, West End, maybe.
It might have been, because I never actually played. I played Top Secret a bit off and on. We'd jump between that and D&D and Gamma World when we weren't playing like a superhero themed game. But one or two guys I knew played the James Bond game, but I just never got into it.
Victory Games.
Okay.
Which is a company I'm not super familiar with.
I remember. Well,
I also know that Super Genius Games did Strike Force 7 for Savage Worlds.
Oh, yeah.
Which was very much in the theme of G.I. Joe.
Right.
You know, I mean, just the cover alone,
Delta Force from Task Force, the Delta Force RPG, the Task Force games put out. Mm-hmm. Any of you guys ever check that out?
No.
You can probably look up a copy online cheap. It actually had a couple decent source books, and at the time, surprisingly, the information on some of the units in there was pretty accurate for the time.
What about Phoenix Command? Did you guys ever see that?
I saw it, but I never played it. I remember seeing it. The girl that was working at the RPG shop I used to go into kept trying to get me to pick it up and try it out, but I never actually picked it up.
It had a role playing game element attached to it, but you can tell that wasn't the main focus. It was meant to be like an add on to supplement other RPGs that gave you RPG equivalents of real life firearm and firearm injury data. The firearm injury tables alone were almost trigonometry in their complexity. It was, I was just like, it came in a small box set with two, like the wire bound binders. Mm-hmm. And it was just like page after page after page. This is the damage that a 9mm would do entering the body this way, from this distance. It was just
that,
like,
almost sounds like a Rollmaster approach to,
right? Yeah, it was crazy.
Oh, you guys ever remember a book called Ultra Modern Firearms? If I remember correctly, the original one came out from was Kevin Dockery put it out. He wrote a couple different books on the SEALs, and I can't remember which game system it was for. And it came out in like the late 80s, early 90s. They've had updated versions for like D20.
Yeah,
because I remember I snapped that up. I was like, at the time, I was like a gun fanatic. I'm like, I wanted all the info on all these different weapons because I wanted the game to be, you know, and then I get to the point where I'm just like, all right, as long as the suckers are hitting, I'm happy. That's way too much detail.
Nice. Right? Yeah, because, I mean, you know, you start getting into that much detail, now you're slowing down things at the table.
Combat was
taking
forever.
You're looking for.
It was a compendium of modern firearms. That was it.
There you go. Did you guys, I apologize. I had to step away for a minute. My dog was having, a tail straightening emergency. For those on the show who don't know, I have a new, German Shepherd puppy, and he's, very needy. So, did you guys talk about Search and Destroy?
Not yet.
No. Let's do that.
We were talking about this the other day on one of the other episodes, but that did a great job of taking the Supers rules and giving them that tactical action feel, taking the very narrative approach that Supers takes and crunching it up a little bit so that you could get that feel of the firearms catalog mixed with good storytelling. So that was very cool.
And I mean, I like he basically took the available rules, took equipment, real life equipment, vehicles, worked up stats for him so it actually works into the Supers games. He made a couple of rule suggestions on how to get things slightly more, one of the more realistic feels of the game. Suggestions on how to, like the chase rules that are in there. Walt had a chance to look them over.
Yeah, it sounds like it would be a great game to run like an Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. game in.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Have you seen it yet, Chuck? Have you gotten a chance to check it out?
No, although I plan to get it. Absolutely.
Don't worry. We will set you up with a copy in a little bit.
Oh, thank you.
perks of being spending some time on a Sunday.
I'm willing to put my credit card down like an adult, but I also not say no to a free copy.
Right on. As far as like RPGs go, you know, we've obviously been talking RPGs in the action genre for a few minutes. We've done a lot of like mechanics talk. What about the role playing side of it? How do you get intrigue and action at the table? I mean, do you have people change their voice and use their James Bond British accent and you know, long sullen silences? I mean, that doesn't really work at the table. How do you bring in intrigue on the at the table?
Well, personally, I like to ask the characters, the players ahead of time, what exactly are you looking for from the game? What do you want to do in the game? What is you trying to achieve? And then try to integrate some of that into the game. If the guy, or like little, especially things like certain character flaws or certain little quirks they have, and add them in. If the guy has a thing for, like, if the guy's an alcoholic, a thing for gambling, something in their background, I try to roll that into the game. Or if they've got an NPC they deal with, or if you're playing more of a spy type game where the guy they leave a few blanks in their background while I have somebody from the past pop up that now might be an adversary they run into, say back when they were in their early 20s, their guy, both of them had served in the same unit in the military, and now this guy's working as a mercenary for, say, like a drug organization or a terrorist group or something like that. Some of them can bump heads again.
Nice.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I'm always a proponent of what I call NPC campaign design. And by that, I mean, again, just kind of based on my feeling about drama in general, I introduce characters and I find out who the players like, who they feel like they can rely on. And then I threaten that. one of the things I always do.
Right on.
You know, if it's a support guy that they always feel that they can rely on and that they like and they joke around with, whether he's a guy who fixes their vehicles in between missions, or, you know, if he's a guy who can supply them with a piece of hardware that they're not supposed to have, the moment that they have someone that they or just that they like personally, then you can get so much mileage out of then having the enemy turn around and recognize that and go after him.
Or you get a guy that, like what I call spotlighting, the other agent to the other guy that's working with him that you just can't stand because he's all about himself, making himself look good, likes to take credit for everybody else's work. When something goes right, it's because of my outstanding planning and my work. And when something goes wrong, it's because you're an idiot and you didn't listen to what I told you to do.
Yes.
That's like Jason Statham's character in that Melissa McCarthy spy movie.
Yes.
Which was awesome.
If anyone ever gets a chance to watch, there's a British series called Spooks, which has been brought to the United States as MI5. In the early seasons of that show, before he moved on to play House, Hugh Laurie plays a senior officer of MI6, who obviously MI5 is not going to like. And
he's a director, right?
I don't think he's the director, but he's I don't know that they ever are totally clear. I guess he is kind of their like a operations director. But he's just strikes a perfect hilarious tone of poncy, arrogant. He always refers to MI5 as little sister. It's an amazingly hilarious performance, and you know they all just want to like put a bullet in the back of his head.
Yeah, when you got players pounding the table with their fists, telling you that they want to go after this bad guy, you know you've done a good job crafting him. What do you guys think of interposing scenes? Recently, on one of the recent episodes of the Happy Jacks RPG podcast, they talk about like what Dom was saying, spotlighting a certain villain. You take your players and have them play mid to low level henchmen of, you know, the big bad guy, and play out a portion of his big plan. So they get just enough information to know how dangerous things are, but not enough information for when they go back to their actual characters to figure out the plot in one sit. What do you guys think of scenes like that?
I've never tried it, to be honest with you.
Yeah, that sounds interesting.
Yeah, I thought it was a neat way to, because I mean, I know Chris McLaughlin and Jason Tondro on some of the other episodes have said that, you know, for the majority of the table in a superhero role-playing game, you know, all the action is focused on the players. You never get that moment where you feel for the bad guy because you really don't know his backstory. Chris tried to defray some of that. I think it was Time of Crisis. His adventure for Mutants and Masterminds. I think that was the adventure. You basically play through the backstory, you know, chasing the backstory of this supervillain, so that by the end of the adventure, you know her backstory, but you also know how to beat her. And I think that that's a neat way, so that you build intrigue that, oh crap, what is this guy really up to, and give the players a taste of the big evil plan. But at the same time, you leave just enough back in the kitchen to where they know the second course is, you know, could potentially really satisfy them.
Okay. Might give it a shot one day and see how that works out.
Nice. Props in action or in action-oriented role-playing games. Do you guys use them at all?
I don't use props, but, you know, I like posting little illustrations online saying you guys may be able to use them in a game, just to give guys that feel of what a particular area looks like that I'm describing. Because, you know, I'm good for posting like the interior of a building, a picture of a street, or something like a firefight going on or something like that. And that way you have something to help them visualize exactly what they're seeing.
Yeah, for modern RPGs especially, it's really easy. Like, there's so much information out there that you're almost... you know, there's almost no reason not to do it, right? If I want to set a scene of a market street in Kabul, I could just find a picture of it, right?
Yeah, right on. One of the Call of Duty Modern Warfare games, you know, they were driving down a street, and it reminded me of a street in Iraq they used to call Market Street in Watermelon Valley. And I'm just sitting there, and I stopped the game, and I went back to a previous checkpoint, and I grabbed my wife because she was there as well. And I sat down, and I said, you got to look at this and tell me what you think. So, you know, you're basically driving in a Humvee in the scene down this road. Mm-hmm. And she was just like, oh my God, that is just like where we were, you know. So that kind of immersion, you just can't beat at a game table.
Was it to the point, do you almost think they just like went there, like with a little handheld video camera?
I think they've used video from the, because you can go online and look at a video. Guys shot video all the time. Guys had GoPro, shot it with a cell phone camera. And I mean, you'll have video online, a guy riding down an ID detonation in front of him. And they just kind of took that and worked with it.
Hell yeah. I mean, stuff like that is fantastic. To go back to the Search and Destroy book, they had John Gibbons doing the art. And his sense of action and scope and scale are just mind-blowing. The art for this was just, I mean, you could almost feel the gritty texture of the gear webbing on some of these tactical harnesses they were wearing in some of the illustrations.
Yeah.
And it doesn't hurt that... John Gibbons himself used to be a soldier for the British military. So, I mean, that kind of thing is just invaluable at a game table, I think, especially for guys who don't have exposure to that. you know, helps them feel like they're actually portraying a character correctly. Yeah. Or not correctly, but, you know, just they get more gravitas to their portrayal.
Yeah, you need enough of a sense of place. You have to be able to suspend disbelief. And weirdly, it's harder in the modern world. You know, if you're running a fantasy game and you're like, well, the elves are like this. Well, no one has ever seen a freaking elf before. So, okay, fine. If you say they're like this, they're like this.
But except in Alan Moore's beard.
Exactly. All elves come from Alan Moore's beard. They spring from his beard, fully grown. But in a modern game, if you... You know, depending on what you want to do, you have to spend more time world building. You know, are suitcase nukes a thing that can exist in this setting? You have to kind of let the PCs know that kind of science fiction tinged technology is around, right?
Very, very creepy.
That's about. I mean, I actually find it's easier for modern games. I can actually, like I said, I can pretty much Google whatever that I'm looking for because I tend to have an idea of what I'm looking for to begin with. I know exactly what I'm searching for, and I'll just be able to pull up a photo of it, or even not necessarily a photo, or somebody's art rendition of a particular setting. Like, say I want a hotel room in Bangkok, Thailand. I can Google it. I'll mark it in, you know, India somewhere, or maybe Afghanistan, or a gritty-looking street in, like, New York, Chicago, Detroit, something like that, or a SWAT team, a particular helicopter, a particular rifle or pistol. I know exactly what I'm looking for, and I'll just Google a term. And that way, look, this is what you guys are looking for. And they have a rough idea in their head. And then I'll just look around for generic-looking thugs or somebody that has a particular look, like an Asian gang lord or something like that. And I can find a photo or a picture online.
And if you're going for total realism, yes. But like what I'm saying is, let's say that you've run a totally realistic game up until now, and you decide to throw in Jaws from the James Bond series. Your players are going to be very shocked and surprised and incredulous. And so, I guess what I meant is you really have to spend more time kind of delineating the rules and if you're deviating from reality, letting them know, like, where.
Well, not necessarily. I don't know necessarily run a completely realistic game if I'm doing something like that. If I'm running like a game with, say, because I establish a tone ahead of time and say, hey, look, this is the type of world you're in. While it's realistic, there's certain elements that are, you know, like I said, you're going to have to suspend disbelief. And so, you know, I might not necessarily have a guy, you know, that's 30 years old that somehow managed to, you know, graduate college at 16, worked for the Central Intelligence Agency, was in Army Special Forces, is now running around. Or I'm looking for a particular type of villain, I might just Google a video game image from certain video games, and they just happen to work for the feel I'm trying to go for.
Right.
I'm not going to have a car that can turn into a submarine in a totally realistic game, but if I'm going for that James Bond feel, it'd work perfectly. And so I just might Google amphibious car.
Yeah. And obviously the...
Which is great in today's day and age that you can Google amphibious
Google is
car.
Google is my friend. It's like the greatest... Yeah. I love Google.
Nice. Nice. One of my friends works in the IT industry and said that, Google is now analogous to Skynet. So he every time I say I love Google, he just sits there and he's like, yep, just keep feeding the machine.
I've been dealing with Google since like 98, 99. I was like, when somebody told me about it, I was like, wow, this is the greatest thing ever.
Oh, wow. That's when cell phones were the size of cell phones.
oh, my God. I remember I was paying $1 a minute.
Oh,
$1 a minute for a cell phone service. And I'm like, you only use this in emergencies. You're dying. Use this phone.
Or after 7 on weekdays. With us coming down to the bottom of the hour, do you guys want to do some final thoughts, final shots about the action genre in general?
I really like the genre.
Dom, did you want to go ahead and kill it?
It's one of my favorites. I'm a big buff for like action movies, war movies, westerns. So I've always been a fan of them. Games, I really wish there were a game system out now that has I'm not quite sure what I'm looking for, just a certain feel to it, when I'm looking forward to a couple of the upcoming movies. Like I said, I don't know why. I know it's probably going to be cheesy, but I still plan to go see Bad Boys 3.
Because you have to.
It's like a bad drug. I just can't stop. I can't quit you.
How about it, Chuck? Final thoughts?
I think modern games are really they're kind of an acquired taste. A lot of players don't think they're going to like modern games, but we're really kind of in the long tail world that we live in, thanks to places like RPG Now. There's really never been a better time to be into modern games. We have so much choice. We're spoiled with choice. And I think that's super great. And I think everyone should try a modern game at least once.
So with Dom's recommendation that somebody should come out with the next great action RPG, could we possibly see a crossover taking your game After Zombies and seeing that go action 11?
You know, it's something I've certainly thought of. I think obviously After Zombies, in my opinion, would be a good base for something like that. In a way, I'm not sure I'm the person to write it. Maybe Dom and I need to have a conversation off air.
Yeah, threaten him with a good time. the only thing I'm going to actually agree with both of you and say that the thing I really enjoy about the action and intrigue genre is always the tightness in my chest for a good action sequence or a good moment of intrigue where it's almost like the first time you ever jump out of an airplane. You know, you look, you know, you turn and face the door. You can feel the wind rushing in and out of the aircraft and your toes are just on the edge, you know, and you get that tightness in your chest that you're holding your breath, but like, you know, you can feel the tension in your chest and in your jaw and everything's just, yeah, all your senses are cranked up to 11 and
you know something's about to happen in your body's.
Yeah, you know, that sense of
that fight or flight is right there. Your brain is trying to figure out what it wants to do.
I love that about action, great action properties and great intrigue properties. And when they mix the two, like in the 24 series
chase scene in Ronin, the car chase.
Oh, yes. Oh, my God. Amazing. You know, you just sit there and you know, you can, you're not in the car, but you can, you feel that sense of impending doom, you know, and it's just fantastic. And I think with entries like Hardcore Henry that are taking the shaky cam movie to the next level and basically putting a GoPro on the main protagonist of the series and you know, filming it in that perspective, you know, you're putting audiences along for the ride. And I think that that's a great aspect to take to a game table. You know, anytime you can take those player characters for a ride along with you and really feel that sense of impending doom. Like if you don't do it, it's not going to get done. And these are the consequences. I think that's a great thing to have at your game table. So with that, like I said, we are at the bottom of the hour. This has been Walt, Chuck, and Dom. And you've been listening to the Genre Series on the Banff Podcast.